This is the Hockey News Podcast.
Hey everybody, the Hockey News Podcast is back. Matt Larkin here, back from my mini vacation with Ryan Kennedy and Ken Campbell reunited. And as we record this puppy, we're preparing for Game 6 of the Sharks and Blues, and very bad news, just minutes before we started recording, we now know Thomas Hertl not playing, Erik Karlsson not playing, Joel Pavelski not playing. So I want to talk about all these guys, but fellas, let's start with Joel Pavelski, okay? So Pavelski actually, I should be more specific, game time decision.
Yes.
And I have a big problem with that personally. You guys know I'm a concussion guy, literally. Like I've had a lot of them. I know what the post-concussion syndrome is like. Joel Pavelski had a bad one. Caused by Cody Eakin in the Vegas series, bloodied and missed multiple games, comes back, gets hit by Alex Pietrangelo. They didn't confirm whether it was concussion again, but we saw the footage. He was very wobbly after, and now he's a game-time decision. So I want to start by saying, should Joel Pavelski have even been in this game? I personally think it was a bad thing that he was even playing at all, but start with that and tell me what you think.
Well, I don't know enough about, and I don't profess to know enough about the treatment and what he did and how he felt. All I know is that he went 15 games without playing, or 15 days without playing, between the time that he got the first concussion and the time he started playing in the Colorado series. 15 days. I think that's enough. I assume that's enough. I think for some people it's enough. For others it isn't. I think part of the problem is, and you know a lot more about this than I do because of your personal experience, Matt, but like from what I've been told, everything I've been told is concussions are like snowflakes. There are no two that are the same. One guy might get a concussion and be ready to play in 3 days. Another guy might get a concussion and not be ready to play for 6 months or ever. So I've got to think that the San Jose Sharks were looking at the long game here and did everything right. I'm going to make that assumption. I'm going to assume that they did that. That they gave him the requisite time that he needed to rest, and that he was cleared to play, and that he was good to go when he went back. And I don't see any reason why it wouldn't have been that way. And I mean, Joel Pavelski is a pending UFA. I don't think Joel Pavelski is going to say, "Well, I got to get back into the lineup so I can prove my worth or whatever." Right? Like he knows he's got to, you know, he's got to keep himself healthy for another contract, right? So I think that, like I said, these are NHL teams. They have very good doctors. I got to think they did the right thing here. And it's just an unfortunate thing that he took another shot to the head. And, you know, I mean, Pietrangelo got that elbow up. There's no question in my mind.
I think it was sort of unlucky because they were glanced off the ref as well. But
I thought he got the elbow up myself. But
yeah. My worry is not so much the first layoff, but the game time decision for Game 6. And Ken, you make a very good point about, you know, the doctors they do have, and concussions are a little more amorphous than, you know, having a sprained ankle or a broken pinky or something like that, where you can clearly define it. But my worry, and this goes for all NHL players, pretty much all high-level hockey players, is that they almost always think they can go.
Right.
They're good enough to make that contribution.
And they don't care sometimes.
They don't care.
For Pavelski, there's a Stanley Cup at stake.
Yeah. And you know what? And, you know, the culture lionizes it, from Bobby Bond to Gregory Campbell, you know, guys finishing shifts or games with literally like broken legs and things like that. And I mean, admittedly, it does sound like a superhero, and it does make for great copy. But for me, just from a pragmatic, competitive standpoint, if you're not 100% in a playoff game, why are you in the lineup? I know everybody's banged up, but if you have a specific malady, somebody else can do the job better, especially if it's a head injury.
Yeah, but you want...
I know you want to.
You'd rather have a 60% Joel Pavelski than a 100% whoever their first guy, the next guy up is.
Maybe, but if you can't do your job 100%, and especially when it comes to... like a concussion where it could affect your vision, it could affect your decision making, your timing.
Yeah.
For me, it's just you actually, I think you're hurting your team because you aren't the exact player that you are professing to be in that right. very moment. And I get what you're saying, where, you know, a black ace is not Joe Pavelski, but at least if you had a black ace in the lineup, they wouldn't be specifically in Pavelski's spot. You'd move somebody else up.
Yeah, yeah.
And that black ace would be tasked with forechecking hard, you know, maybe, you know, killing a penalty, but really just, you know, being an energy guy, whereas you would bring somebody else up in the lineup to be that more two-way guy who can score. It's just, for me, it sets everything out of whack in your group, and the player himself is never going to say, eh, I feel a little off, maybe I shouldn't play.
Yeah,
they
captain.
Want it too bad. Yeah, yeah, exactly, especially with Joe Pavelski. I mean, he's Mr. Character.
See, what I find troubling here is I mean, we don't know what this is. So we don't know that it's a concussion. And we'll probably never find out because they're not going to be saying it now. But if it is one, why would he be a game time decision? If
right.
he's concussed, he's concussed. He's not going to be ready in he's not going to be any better 5 hours later, right?
Yeah.
And when it comes to a brain, like if there's even a question, if there needs to be a decision made, if there's any doubt in your head that you don't feel right in your brain, to me the idea of him playing is very icky. And I know it hasn't been officially confirmed that it was concussion, but I mean we saw the footage. He was Bambi out
there. It was concussion-esque.
He was wobbly. Like that's the exact type of behavior a concussion spotter would go for. And big picture, a problem that I have is I agree with you both, and you know Ryan used the word amorphous, Ken Snowflake. I think they both apply. They both mean the same thing in this case. We don't know much about concussions. But what's always bothered me about the game is when we know so little, why do we err on the side of, we should err on the side of caution. If we know so little about the long-term effects,
it
shouldn't be, well, because we don't know that he's not okay, we may as well, like there's no signs that he's still hurt. I guess we can take the chance and put him back in there. How about we go the other way and say, because we know so little, what if there's a mandatory rule that if you suffer a concussion, you must miss a minimum of 10 NHL games, something like that, just to give you that extra time, because second impact syndrome is a major problem. It's what cost Sidney Crosby about a year and a half of his career. And what's kind of creepy, you'll see a story coming up from me. I spoke to this inventor, Ryan Moore, who had some very harrowing concussion experiences. He's invented a new way to treat concussions, patent pending. So there's a story coming up. But when I was talking to Ryan, we had a conversation. This was just last week. And he said, I can't believe Joe Pavelski's back in after the Eakin hit. He said he shouldn't eat, like he was unconscious, bleeding, just completely out. The fact that he's still playing right now is so scary. And then what happens the very next day? He gets hit again. Because he was probably back in too early. But if there was some kind of mandatory rule, again, maybe it's 20 games. When it comes to brains, you're better off being overly safe than I think playing it too lackadaisical.
Mm. And I think one thing that I would bring up, and this goes to, you know, the fighting debate as well, is I think at this point, there's enough information out there for current players where they're making these decisions. And if we want to be more safe, Matt, then you're totally right about going 10, 20 games. It's hard to imagine the players ever agreeing to that, even if it's in their own best interest, because they want to be out there. And I think at this point, they understand the risks, but it has to be a decision made for them.
But to me, yeah, and to me, then you, if that's the case, then don't come back 20 years after your career's over and sue the league.
Totally.
You know what I mean? Like,
well,
then they
wouldn't, right?
If they had a rule like that in place, the next generation would
say, okay, well, we were properly protected because we were given all these extra games, even though we felt fine, just to make sure.
Yeah.
Something to consider. Sticking with the Sharks, okay, so we know for a fact at this time that Erik Karlsson's not playing. He missed 29 games in the regular season, a groin problem, and of course, dating back a couple years ago, had half the left ankle, the bone removed. And he's coming up on his UFA year, and most speculation suggests he's going to ask for something along the lines of what Drew Doughty got, which is an $11 million cap hit. If it's open market, that's 7 years, 77. If he stays with the Sharks, it's 8 years, 88. And two Norris trophies for Karlsson, production and minutes, everything pretty similar to Doughty, aside from the Stanley Cups, of course. But now I'm wondering, at what point does Karlsson start to hurt his value and his dollar figure because of the durability concerns? He's going to be 29 at the end of May. Do you think that suddenly there's going to be $1 million shaved off that AAV, or do you think he's still going to get paid?
To me, it's not the dollar figure you worry about here.
It's the term.
It's the term.
Yeah.
It's the term.
That's it.
It's the term. I would be very, very skittish about signing Erik Karlsson to a 7 or 8 year deal.
Mm-hmm.
Like that to me. Like you don't mind paying him 8 to 10 or maybe even $11 million. it's the term that's going to kill you on this one.
I wouldn't go more than five.
Yeah.
Because worst case scenario, you work out something with Seattle in a couple of years to get it off your books.
Yeah, but you can't do that. He's going to ask for a no move. And you're going to have to protect him. So that I don't think that's going to be an option.
I guess.
I really do think if it hurts him, it's going to be on term. It's not going to be on money. Well, ultimately, that is money because he's not getting those years.
But it's term.
It's insurance term. for the team that takes him and says, we like you with both ankles. We're still pretty happy with 1.5 ankles. But I think if you look at his season as a whole, it was very up and down. And, I mean, he's still Erik Karlsson. The upside is still definitely there.
If he's healthy.
But it is that big if. And I think 5 years at like 9, it's going to sound like you're underpaying. But I think if you're going to be realistic, because, I mean, that Doughty contract is already looking like, man, I mean, Doughty's still good, but is he $11 million for the foreseeable future good? Like, when is that deal going to start looking
bad? Or you sign him with the full realization you're only getting 50 games a year out of him.
Right.
And you don't mind that. Like, to me, it's almost like he's become the second coming of Peter Forsberg. Oh.
And of Jenny Malkin.
What's that?
And of Jenny Malkin. You know you're going to get
miss
13 games a year or whatever.
No, but I mean, with Forsberg in the last however many years of his career, you literally did not know from one game to the next whether he was going to be playing,
whether
he was going to be healthy. You could never, ever actually count on him being in the lineup.
Yeah.
And that might be where this is headed, you know?
It could be. I actually predict that Karlsson is still going to get term and the big money because of the market, okay? So if you look at who's out there, it's an awesome free agent class for forwards, but for defensemen, it's pretty weak. At the top, you've got Karlsson, and then it drops from Karlsson to Jake Gardner and Tyler Myers. That's how big of a gap it is, and after them, it's a huge gap. So the demand, especially right-handed shots, right now the balance in the league is still about 60% lefty, 40% righty, so there's still that premium, just like left-handed starting pitchers in baseball. So it's really Karlsson and Tyler Myers. Tyler Myers is going to make a lot of money, whether he deserves it or not, for the same reason. And I think that someone is going to give Karlsson term just because that's going to be the winning bid. So I suspect he's still going to get at least 7 years if he wants it. And what's interesting is that in our upcoming issue, which is a free agent issue, which should be hitting newsstands any day now. And if you're watching on video, I've got it right here. Okay. I crunched the numbers to see if Karlsson's play really was declining, because that was the narrative this year. You know, the goal total's down, and there was, you know, visually he didn't look like himself. He didn't look as swift, and there was the uneven season. That was a perception. But I went kind of under the hood looking at all the analytical numbers, and what was fascinating to me was that other than the fact that he post-ankle surgery was rushing the puck a little bit less, all those under-the-hood numbers are just as good as they ever were, even at his peak in Ottawa, suggesting that his overall impact on the flow of the puck in the game hasn't changed. It just feels like it, and obviously he's not on the ice.
Exactly. But if you can't play, you can't have a positive effect.
Your Corsi is zero.
Yes, which is fair. It's more the narrative that when he is playing, he's not as good, I don't think is true.
Right.
And even the goal total, his shooting percentage was unnaturally low this year, so that should regress to the mean positively in the future. So I think when he's on the ice, you're still going to get that really good Erik Karlsson for several more seasons. Obviously, massive risk. I think the market, whether he deserves it or not, is still going to give him the deal he wants.
Right.
So the Bruins are just sitting around. They're waiting for the Stanley Cup to start as of now. Does it feel to you guys like they are the team to beat, and do they have the inside track on San Jose or St. Louis, regardless of who advances?
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I wish I could remember where I said it, because at some point I had one radio hit where I was like, it's going to be like a Boston-St. Louis final. And all the other times I said Tampa Bay, so I'm not going to pat myself on the back. But at one point I said Boston. But I think the key now is that they do have all this rest. And, I mean, Ken, we've talked about it so many times where the Stanley Cup is a war of attrition, where the longer you go, the more banged up you get. The Bruins have this amazing week off at the perfect time. They're actually holding a scrimmage for their fans this week where they're going to actually, like, go at it with each other. It'll be like a black and gold game. And I think that's brilliant because, you know, that way they can keep that edge. But you look at this group and everything is going according to plan right now, where Tuukka Rask is an A1 goaltender, not a 1A, A1.
A1.
You know, all the experience that they've accrued over the years is paying off. Guys are stepping up. You know, Zdeno Chara out of the lineup, no problem. We'll just, you know, have Connor Clifton having an excellent game.
Yeah.
You know, Sean Corrali has been excellent for them since he came back in the first round.
Huge catalyst.
Huge catalyst with size and speed. And, of course, you know, you go to the very top. Brad Marchand, I'm going to say now he's not going to win the Conn Smythe because of the way that he treated the media, and because the media alone votes on that. I don't have a vote.
Yeah, I still think but it's two guys. I think it's Rask either way.
It's probably Rask either way, but tiebreaker goes to
the
nice
guy. To the good guy.
Yeah, exactly. But Marchand has been amazing.
Outstanding. Torrey Krug has been a beast.
Oh,
has
huge.
He's been a beast. He's been outstanding.
A big eye-opener, yes. And so you look at that, it's like, well, what else do they need? It's like they kind of have it all, and they're a smart team.
Yeah.
And they're going to be facing somebody that's banged up and a little, at least, more tired than they are.
Yeah, I mean, if I'm an NHL team, I will take the rest 100 times out of 100.
Mm-hmm.
I'll take the rest over and risk being rusty for the first period of the next series anytime at this time of the year.
Yeah.
And I think that's going to be a huge factor for the Bruins. And I think, you know, I mean, they're notwithstanding the fact that they're the best team left.
Yeah.
They're the best team left by a considerable margin, in my opinion. Tuukka Rask is completely dialed in. He doesn't even have to play as well as he's playing. He just has to play okay, but he's playing amazing. Mm-hmm. You know, he's giving them that kind of goaltending that even if they were getting outshot by 14 shots a game, they'd still win. So I don't see anybody stopping them.
And no matter who they play, whether it's San Jose or St. Louis, it's going to be a physical series.
Right. Yep.
And that benefits them as the rested team.
Yeah.
And I see a distinct advantage, two different ones over each team for Boston too. So let's say San Jose, they find a way to gut it through. Then Boston has a massive goaltending advantage over Martin Jones in the series based on Martin Jones' uneven playoffs. I would argue that for the most part, the Sharks have won in spite of him, not because of him. And if St. Louis gets through, maybe the goaltending is more even with Binnington there. But I think firepower, Boston has the edge over what the Blues have been bringing. Like where San Jose could match Boston's offense, San Jose's really deep team, probably deeper than Boston even. But so I just see one crucial edge that would put Boston in front either way. And also the Bruins' power play is 34% in the playoffs, humming along.
Yeah.
So I think we're all in agreement there that they're
the fact that San Jose's got an elimination game and three of their best players aren't playing. You know, I mean,
tough sledding.
I mean, that indicates to me that there's some gas. They're running out of gas. They're running on fumes. So
When you're relying on like Joe Thornton to be the guy that's still got gas in the tank. Then it's a little scary.
One other X factor is if they play St. Louis, it's the David Backes Bowl. That's a motivator for Boston to get him his ring. I feel with teams that have won it recently, and I'll count the Bruins in that respect because you still got players from that run. You need a motivator. You need a totem of some sort. David Backes is that totem.
And then if San Jose goes through, obviously it's the Joe Thornton Bowl, but also the Martin Jones Bowl. He was a Bruin for like
10 minutes.
That's right. How dare you flip me?
Somebody out there has a Jones jersey where they're like, I bought it, and then on eBay.
You know what? You should have a Jones jersey that's like not finished, like John, and then it stops.
There's like a three on the left side, but they didn't know if he'd be 30 or 31, and then you got traded, and they're like, forget it.
All right, Ryan, let's do a little future watch. Tell us what prospects you have your eye on right now.
Yeah, so there's not a lot of prospects still playing. We actually did a nice little video late last week that was X Factors for the Memorial Cup. So I'm going to stay away from Memorial Cup guys and go to the National Junior A Championship, which just wrapped up. The Brooks Bandits won it, but they played Prince George in the final, the Spruce Kings, and Prince George has a very nice 2019 draft prospect in defenseman Leighton Ahak. He's an Ohio State commit. He had 3 goals in 6 games at the Junior A Championship, but offense is really not his specialty. He is a puck mover. He's a good mobile kid, 6'2", has a nice frame to build on, But I've had him described to me as sort of a Chris Tanev type by scouts. So he's very good defensively, as well as having a little bit of offensive pop. You know, this is the type of kid that you're going to wait a couple of years before he even gets a sniff at the pros, and that's fine. I see him as probably being like a second or third rounder. But, you know, good for him and the Spruce Kings going all the way to the final and getting a little more exposure for him. So it'll be fun to see what he does there. As for drafted prospects, I'll head over to the Calder Cup. The AHL is now in the semifinal. The San Diego Gulls are taking on the Chicago Wolves in the West. And Sam Steele, the Anaheim Ducks first rounder, 12 points in 12 playoff games for the Gulls so far. He's been very good. And, you know, this is a player who's really right on the cusp where we know he has the talent. He got a little bit of experience with Anaheim this season, and I think that helped sending him, you know, to the AHL where he could get some more minutes, get some more reps. And based on where Anaheim is in their rebuild right now, there's going to be opportunities for young guys like Steele, like Maxime Comtois, who's also having a nice playoff run, like Troy Terry, you know, another good young player they have. But I think Sam Steele, he's getting some really good time in these playoffs, and that'll really help him next year.
For sure. And the thing with Steele, I feel like his spot on the depth chart is almost guaranteed because of the status of Ryan Kessler, whose career might be over. They're very serious hip problems.
Well, he's not. They've already said he's not playing next year.
Yeah. So that's going to open up the spot.
So that leaves a spot right there.
Especially for Steele, who's a center. But I think Comtois was really good in limited action before he got hurt and then went to the World Juniors. But he looked like he belonged right off the bat last year as well.
So. And Comtois is the type of player where, because he can do so many different things, like, he doesn't need to be on your top line or even your second line. Like, he can be a great contributor in a bottom six role if that's all you have for him. Obviously, the Ducks have a little more flexibility right now.
Next up, a little talk about From the Magazine, the current one. I've probably shown it already, but if you haven't seen it, it's the free agency issue. A lot of good stuff in there, including in our team previews, we actually call Carolina. We literally list them as a bunch of jerks, which I appreciate.
That was great.
That was awesome.
Whoever came up with that.
It made it all the way to print.
Awesome.
But in there, I have a story on what I like to refer to as the Loch Ness Monsters, offer sheets. There's been so much talk, offer sheet, oh my God, oh, Mitch Marner. And I've always had a theory that there's no way in hell that a marquee name like that is going to get an offer sheet. Hasn't been an offer sheet to any player in the past 6 years, and it was only a two-year deal or three-year deal. It was a short-term deal to Ryan O'Reilly. So I decided to dig in more and to find out if my theory really is true, that it's almost impossible for it to happen. And I sort of came away still feeling that way. One thing I did was crunch the numbers just to find out how difficult the draft pick compensation is, because it's not as simple as looking at the number and saying, okay, are we willing to pay this much, whatever it is, you know, over $10.4 million, whatever the number is, and surrender four first rounders. It's more complicated than that, because even if you're trying to just get under it, when they're calculating a contract, they divide it by a different number. So the AAV, if you sign a guy 7 years, $70 million, you divide that by seven, right? So it's $10 million a year. But for the sake of draft pick compensation, you divide that by five. So the cap hit becomes $14 million just for the compensation chart. So it's so much more difficult than people think just to spend the right amount of money to get under the four first rounder threshold. And what ends up happening is you actually have to spend so little because of that divide by five factor that the number you end up coming up with, the team will match easily, or the player will say, well, that's way too little. And I did talk to Kevin Lowe and Dustin Penner about the barn fight situation. And another major factor, of course, in offer sheets is bad blood between GMs. And Kevin Lowe did say, he was very candid about it, and he said, I don't regret what I did. Brian Burke and I were good friends, and ultimately, I was most beholden to my fan base, not my friend. But what I said to Kevin was, at the same time, you know that that burned a bridge, and you have to be very careful. If you do it, then you could be damaging your relationship with another trade partner. So that's another strike. The other strike being, of course, that the player has to agree to do it. And I talked to Penner about that. He was a unique situation because there was a major discrepancy between his team's valuation of him and what the Oilers were willing to pay him. So in that case, the money was so much more, he almost had to go. But that doesn't happen very often where you get that type of situation. I could go on and on, but it's a pretty long list of why offer sheets are so rare. It's far more likely for sort of a marginal guy where one team will just value a team differently than his current team, so they're willing to pay a lot more money. But if you want to learn more about it, it gave me a migraine just doing all this math. But it was interesting in the end, so go check it out. Okay, Kenneth, it's time for the hot take of the week.
Well, last week, San Jose Sharks coach Peter DeBoer said it was a ridiculous statement to say that the San Jose Sharks have been lucky in these playoffs. And you know what? I agree with him 100%. I agree with him 100%. You do not get to the conference final only by being lucky. You know, I mean, they scored 4 power play goals in 4 minutes. Lucky teams don't do that. Mm-hmm. You know, the Gabriel Landeskog offside, that's a call that 30 other teams in the NHL, including the Avalanche, would have made in the same situation. Anybody who's got a video coach worth his salt is going to see that. They're going to make that call at that time, and they're going to get that call because it was the right call. If you whether you like it, hate it, whatever, it was still the right call. And then in game 3, the hand pass, you know, I mean, yeah, okay, they got the goal, but who's to say they wouldn't have scored 5 minutes later? You know, I mean, everybody talks about how in 1999, the Buffalo Sabres lost the Stanley Cup because Brett Hull was standing in the crease. No, they didn't. I mean, but, yeah. I mean, that goal might have been called back, and it should have been called back, but Dallas might have scored 30 seconds after
and
that.
And the series ended in 6 games. It wasn't in game 7. Games.
So, no, you don't get that far by being lucky. You get that far by being really good at the right time of year, and the Sharks are putting everything together. And really, the only one where you can really say that it was a luck-based thing was the major penalty
right
against Vegas, where they actually scored 4 goals in 4 minutes. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I mean, yeah, they were lucky. They were really lucky that Vegas couldn't kill a penalty to save their lives. They were really lucky that they scored an overtime, double overtime shorthanded in game 6 of that series. They were really lucky that Vegas choked up a 3-1 lead. Yeah, I guess they were lucky about all that stuff.
I think I agree with you for the most part. The only different way I would spin it is that every championship team has luck to go along with all the things they do well. I think you need it. So if you look back at the history of champions, there's always, there have been some fortunate things that have happened for every one of those teams. Sure, of course.
Yeah.
But yeah. Cool story, bro, I guess. time for some mailbag questions. First one is from Playoff Marty, who, by the way, during the regular season, this guy goes by Regular Season Marty. I remember that, Marty.
Wow.
I pay attention to you. I see you, Marty.
So will he be off-season Marty soon?
I believe
he
will.
Does he ever do, like, World Championship Marty, World Juniors Marty?
No, that would be too irrelevant, because the World Championship's irrelevant.
I didn't say that.
I did. So Playoff Marty asks, which player is most likely to be traded at the draft? I feel names like Tyler Johnson, PK Subban, Willie Nylander, and Phil Kessel coming up. Most of those names I agree with. I don't think we're going to see Nylander go because Kyle Dubas made that sort of promise that he wants to at least give that core a shot.
And he's killing
ripping
it
up
at the
world.
Tournament
yes.
And he's
that
ripping
you
up.
Hate.
Yes. Damn it. Oh, my God. I didn't realize I was going to come back to bite me like 14 seconds later. Jeez. But I'll lead off the answer here with I think Phil Kessel is the guy because Jim Rutherford is the perfect storm of extremely aggressive GM, even when things are going well with his team. And now he knows he has to blow things up. And whether he's going to sort of retool and do a mini rebuild or whether he's going to keep a foot on the gas, either way, the Penguins have no cap space, so you're going to have to move a body. So even if Rutherford said, no, we're going pedal to metal, we're going to contend, it would probably require getting a defenseman, and doing that would probably mean sending Phil Kessel out. And that's why there have been some rumors of Kessel for PK Subban, as an example. Mm-hmm. But to me, Kessel is the most likely player, I think, to be traded this offseason, just because we can always rely on Jim Rutherford to do something.
And if Jenny Malkin is not going to be traded,
I don't think so.
He's not. No. I can tell you right now, that is not going to happen.
So you're saying, is this like you know, or is this speculation? Or are you saying, like, wink, wink?
No, I know.
Oh, Ken knows everybody. He knows.
I'm going off the board on this one. I think it's Jacob Trouba.
I don't think that's off the board.
Yeah. Well, I'm
off
the board.
Oh, yeah.
In as much as it wasn't one of the bunch of guys that playoff. Grandpa has to lift his glasses up again. Playoff Marty mentioned.
Right. Okay.
I think that, you know, I think it's time for him to leave. It's obvious he's not going to stay. He's got a year left. I think he's a lot more valuable to a team in terms of trade with a year left on his contract. So I think he's the guy that's going to get dealt at the draft.
Mm, I'm going to go off the board too. Kevin Shattenkirk with the New York Rangers has a no trade clause, but it's not airtight. You know, I think there's a limited list of teams. You know, the Rangers are in the midst of a rebuild, which is going very nicely so far. Adam Fox signed with them, a very coveted NCAA player who was first Calgary, then Carolina.
He finally found the Rangers. Team he felt like going to, I guess.
Exactly. Yeah. And the thing about Shattenkirk is, you know, his contract goes for a couple more years and his value has slipped, I would say. But the Rangers have several second rounders, so if they needed to sweeten the pot in a deal to ditch that salary, they have the flexibility to do so. So I think that would be the case where, you know, they could get even stronger for the future making a deal for Shattenkirk, where even if it's not the most appealing contract for another team, I think a deal could be swung where both parties would be pretty happy.
Interesting. And I'm thinking, because of course Shattenkirk, that's a hometown contract that he signed, so that sort of decreases the odds of him wanting to leave, I think, unless he just crossed the old Hudson River to a team that could use a defenseman, maybe a mentor for Ty Smith in New Jersey, and that has tons of cap space available as well, or even the Islanders too. The Islanders, depending on which guys they re-sign, they might also have a ton of cap space.
I think there's some guys too that, like, their attitude, and I don't know what his thinking is, but there's some guys that, like, I don't want to be at a party where they don't want me.
Right.
You know? Like,
right.
if you don't want me, if you really don't want me, then let's make something happen here. Mm-hmm. Let's move.
That's why I've always said that, like, whenever I talk about a trade candidate or whatever on Twitter and someone says, no trade clause, I'm always like, and no trade, schmo trade.
Yeah.
Because, and that's what happens.
No trade means control trade.
Yeah, control
trade. That's what it means.
But Scott Hartnell was an example I always think of, where he was fine to go to Columbus because he said, well, I'm not wanted here. So when they traded him from Philly to Columbus, right?
Right, right.
So that exact thing happened. I'm with you all the way.
No trade just means not Edmonton.
Edmonton burn. Next question is from Al. Or is it AI? I think it's Al.
The robots are coming.
Al. I should read the question in a robot voice just in case it's AI. How long before Patrick Waugh loses his mind if he comes to Ottawa? probably pretty quick.
Yeah.
What do you think?
Oh, yeah. I think he's probably already losing his mind that people are mentioning him. although I will say.
Together.
Oh, that'd be fun.
That would be a stew, wouldn't it?
I will say, though, that Patrick Waugh would be a pretty good fit for the Senators.
Damn,
because they have so much good young talent, and he's so good at harnessing young players.
And he's a good coach.
He's a good coach.
He's a damn good coach.
Do we know that he's a good NHL coach, though? Like, he had one really good year with Colorado that was known as, like, one of the flukiest seasons of all time.
Yes.
Like, their analytics were terrible, and then they bombed the next year.
Yes.
But you still think he's a good NHL coach?
I think he deserves another shot with a better roster. Not that the Senators are a better roster than those Colorado Avalanche were. But if you gave him time to grow with that lineup, then it's like, well, what's a Patrick Waugh team with a Thomas Chabot in his prime, a Brady Tkachuk in his prime, you know, Logan Brown,
Colin White,
Drake Batherson, Brandstrom,
yeah, like so many, like there's so many young elements there that if you came up together, that could be kind of intriguing. But Roy and Melnick, I don't know.
I think it would be awesome.
Actually,
I think it would be awesome.
Because you would hear it from both barrels.
And I'm not sure that wouldn't be part of the grand plan, is like Bon Cop, Bad Cop. You know what I mean? Like Patrick Roy is the guy that represents the fans. And I can't work with this guy.
It would steal attention away from Melnick in a good way for Melnick's sake.
Exactly. It's almost like a Vince McMahon like world wrestling thing where Melnick could be like, I'm the bad guy, but you're coming to the arena, so I'm happy because I'm making money finally. Yeah.
Interesting. I am sort of excited like down the road, but I think Ottawa does have quite a nice roster of prospects now. It's just a matter
absolutely.
Of... And we've talked about this before on the podcast, but it's a matter of you can't just have nothing but kids. You have to have some blend of veterans to help mentor those kids along.
Yeah. Right.
Otherwise, you can get that losing culture.
I think that's a possibility. That would be... Yeah. Because, I mean, right now, Colin White's our number one center.
Wow.
Right? He is.
Yeah.
He is.
That's wild.
And so you do need, in that vein, like you bring him back, he provides that sort of mentorship. It's a great story. It's, you know, I'm sure he'd be happy to be back. He'd probably be reinvigorated.
Yeah. On the other hand, then, you know, in 8 months, we're like, okay, but Jason Spezza is your number one center.
Yeah.
Well, then they can help them tank for the... number one pick next
year. There you
year.
Go.
Colorado doesn't have next year's number one pick, right?
Right.
Just not yet.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, just that one, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. So we'll somehow find out that Patrick Waugh's rights were actually still owned by Colorado, and they have to, like, you know. Ottawa has to give up their first rounder. It's like, we didn't know. This is terrible.
One of my favorite things ever to happen to me on Twitter involved Jason Spezza, and it was right before Ottawa traded him to Dallas, and I wrote, like, a story on, like, trade destinations for Jason Spezza because he'd requested a trade and his mom retweeted it.
Nice.
Which is pretty awesome. Yeah. Cool story, bro. Kind of actual cool story,
that
bro.
Is actually yeah, cool
decent story,
yeah,
bro.
Yeah, not bad. Yeah.
Okay, we're going to finish it off with Ville Penninen, and Ville says, if the Bruins can't go all the way this time, should Don Sweeney think of some sort of reboot, minor changes, or hard boot, interesting word, Ville, making some really radical offseason moves of the core. Personally, I don't think we should expect much to change on a drastic level in Boston, because you had a great year and you're in the Stanley Cup final, but also cap-wise, yeah. Boston's got Charlie McAvoy and Brandon Carlo, restricted free agents, and they only have, I checked today, I think it's about $14 million,
right.
And those two could eat up all of that.
Yep.
So doesn't mean Boston's going to do nothing, but I don't think an overhaul is in order.
No, not at all.
I think they're in a nice sweet spot where their veterans are still good and they still have kids coming up. Even though Jacob Forsback of Carlson is actually going back to Sweden to play for Vaxio next year. That was just announced today. But they still have those young kids coming up that will be getting better. Like, McAvoy's somehow going to get even better than he is now.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just a fact. Like, he's already amazing and he's going to get even better. I even think, you know, like Brandon Carlo has been really good for them, and he's going to be more of that Chara, you know, reach guy, defensive defenseman that they're going to need once Chara retires, whenever that will be.
My question is, why would you change this team?
Yeah, I think
what
sitting
part
pretty.
Of it would you change? I mean, yeah, David Backus making $6 million isn't great. That's not great.
I think they could use another depth forward,
yeah,
like a Kevin Hayes if they could afford him, like a local boy.
Yeah, but I mean, you talk about depth. I mean, this is a team that has depth at pretty well every position.
And all you can ask for is to get your team to the Stanley Cup final.
Yeah.
Once you're there, anything can happen. You never know, you know, how momentum's going to swing, things like that. If you're Don Sweeney, you have gone above and beyond.
Yeah.
You got your team to the final. You give them a chance to win. That's all you can ask for.
And until they prove otherwise, you've still got the best first line in the world.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
That's right. Okay, everybody, that's it for this week. And stay tuned. The next time you hear us, we will be in Boston at the Stanley Cup final. So stay
wicked
tuned.
Awesome.
Wicked awesome. Wicked awesome. How's that? Good? No? No? I don't know. See you later.